This recording is being made by Mr. B.O. Webster, and it's at the library, August 10th, 1960.
The history of this fish hatchery that I presume you'd like to have is told in not a great many words, but it began in 53 years ago in 1907. It was instituted by Mr. Nevins, who was then superintendent of fisheries, and was employed by the then five-man fish commission. It was his desire to have a place where he could raise fish to larger than the small size that they were in the habit of planting at that time, which was shortly after the fish had absorbed their sacks. And when I talked with him in Washington, he told me that he had a place that he would like to have me come and take charge of. I at that time was employed by the state of Pennsylvania. He said, if you'll come over to my room, I'll show you some of the pictures that I've made of the place, and it's going to be the greatest brook trout hatchery in the United States, without any exception. I went to his room and looked his pictures over, but couldn't tell very much about the place, but agreed that if he would pay me enough, I would quit the state of Pennsylvania, where I was employed at that time, and come over to Wisconsin and work for the state of Wisconsin, which I was desirous of doing because I'm a Michigan man, was born in Michigan, and the central part of the United States appealed to me a great deal more than the eastern part of the country did. And I was very glad to get back here in this part of the country and work for the state of Wisconsin. Came here to Wild Rose in about the 28th of March, 1909. The work, there had been 2 years' work on the fish hatchery, and 4 or 5 ponds had been built. The property was bought by the commission from Willem Jones, who signs the deed. He and Mrs. Jones signed the deed. And the price of the property at the time was $2,500. The state paid for it. The property across the street, across the road, I think was bought at the same time, but very little improvement was made on it for a considerable length of time. When I came here, we landed here in this beautiful little town on the 28th of March with the snow fairly well gone, but the lovely sand roads were a mush of sand and water, and at that time there was a bus running from the station to the hotel, and was operated by, what's that man's name?
James Robert?
No,
Prothero?
Prothero, Chick Prothero. And the hotel was run then by Uptons. Many men who traveled at that time traveled by railroad, and they knew what was necessary to get to the hotel without having to walk, and they all got out of the train quickly and filled the old bus full, and Mrs. Webster and my daughter and old man Nevins and I had to walk from the depot to the hotel. All of us caught cold and were sick as we could be afterward. Our goods had been shipped from Pennsylvania and were stored in the little old house that is on the other side of the street, other side of the road from the hatchery. And we took up our abode there. And I well remember the entrance to the building that we made with Mr. Nevins. And he was very much pleased with the attitude of my wife, who didn't say a word about what she saw. Because as we went into the house, there was a large place where the plaster had fallen off of the room. And I know that if Mrs. Nevins had been introduced to a place like that to live in, she would have probably did something to Mr. Nevins. But Mrs. Webster never said a word, and Nevins was very much impressed and spoke about it at different times afterward. We took up our abode there, and I commenced to operate the fish hatchery and built some ponds. And one of the remarks that Mr. Nevins made to me when he spoke about our going to look at the pictures in Washington was that when this hatchery was built and completed, there never would be a trout planted from it until it was fingerling size. Well, about 2 years afterward, he and I were walking around the ponds, and I said, I guess it was more than 2 years afterward, but one time afterward when I was up here with him, I said, do you remember what you said to me in Washington about getting the fish planted out of this place? And never one until they were fingerling size. And he looked over at me and he says, yes, and we've been awful glad to get them planted with their sacks on. The fact of the matter was that we found out after a year or so that this water in this fish hatchery here is not adapted for the propagation of brook trout at all. And eventually the propagation of brook trout has been completely discontinued, and brown trout and rainbow trout have been hatched here since then. That was a great disappointment to Mr. Nevins, I know. I lived here from, say, the 1st of March until the 1st of August, when I was appointed assistant superintendent to Mr. Nevins and was transferred to Madison, Wisconsin to live. And at the time of my transfer, Mr. Zalsman, who was then in charge of the fish hatchery at Bayfield, was transferred down here. We discovered when we moved into the house that it was populated with almost everything that was known to be disagreeable in a household, including bed bugs and snakes and mice and ants and, well, anything else you can think of. When Zalsman moved in, he wrote me and said, I never knew I had so many ants before. Zalsman, I presume some of you know, remember him, was a loud-spoken man. And when he'd go to the house to telephone, which he had to do if he wanted to telephone downtown, he'd holler so loud that the boys who were working on the grounds said to him one day, why do you use the telephone? They could hear you downtown without you using the telephone. Well, Zalsman stayed here for a while, and then I can't remember just who followed Zalsman, but it seems to me it was Mr. Ben Durkee. But previous to my coming here, Mr. Henry Sykes had charge of the work here and did the building of the ponds that were made up to the time I came. Since there has been several men, including Cliff Hills and I don't remember the name of the man who is here now, but I had several men from here, from this station, that were promoted to take charge of stations in other parts of the state, including one of your local boys, Losey Stewart, who has just, in fact, just been retired, and a party was given for him just a short time ago. I think perhaps the most successful years that the hatchery was operated was during the time that Mr. Cliff Hill was in charge. I always appreciated very much his work, and he was a very capable fellow. I transferred him from this station to the Madison station, and he had charge of that station in Madison for a long time. During my administration of the fisheries operations, which began in 1922, after Mr. Nevins was fired by Governor Blaine, he appointed me a member of the Conservation Commission, which were made up of three men at that time. Mr. Nevins was a commissioner, and I took his place. Mr. Harrington was a commissioner, and Mr. Barber. I meant to mention some of the men that were on the old Fish Commission that were with Mr. Nevins, or that Mr. Nevins was working under during the time this hatchery was built. I only remember a few. There was a five-man commission, but I can remember only three of them. One was Mr. Burns of La Crosse, and Dean Burge of Madison, and a launderman. What in the world was his name now? He was from Madison also. The other two men, I don't remember who they were. This fish hatchery has been advertised as one of the outstanding places to visit by tourists and by people who drove through the state, because of its beauty and because of the fact that it was very well taken care of and very, very beautiful place to come to. Well, I don't know what else I can tell you about it, I'm sure, unless you have some questions to ask.
I think it'd be interesting, Mr. Webster, to tell about the old fish car they used to distribute fish.
That was an interesting program. At the time that I came into the state, we had a fish car that we used to keep here at Wild Rose. We had a car barn, and during the time it was not being used, we used to keep the railroad car here. The car was built under the instructions of Mr. Nevins by the Pullman Company in Chicago at a cost of $13,500. It had 10 tanks on either side of the car, with sleeping quarters and an office equipped with all the necessary things to do writing and take care of the correspondence and so forth that had to be carried down on the car, as well as to be used as a dining room with sleeping quarters for seven men. The railroads of the state of Wisconsin at that time used to transport that car free of charge, and a great many times we used the Northwestern Road more than any of the other roads, and we got great accommodations from them. One of the interesting things about the handling of that car was that we would run it into Milwaukee at the fair time with a big load of fish for exhibition purposes. And of course, everybody wanted to get out to the fair that had anything to get out there, like any exhibits or anything of that kind. And when we came into that railroad station in Milwaukee, it was a hubbub that was almost impossible to do anything with. But whoever was in charge of the car managed to see that there were several dead fish on board, and the man who was in charge of getting an engine to get us out to the fairground was told that we got to get out there, we've got some live fish, and we've got some nice fish for it to eat. And one or two fish given to those fellows down there on the railroad would get us out to the fair without any trouble at all. The first year that I went to Madison after coming into the state, Miss Nevin sent me down on the Mississippi River to collect bass from the sloughs of the river. The river is entirely changed now with great big dams, and there are no more sloughs on the river, but at that time there was no dams on the river, and the water in the spring would rise to a flood stage almost, and the fish in the river would go out and spawn, and the water would go down and leave an enormous number of holes filled with little fish, and we'd go down there and seine them out of these holes and bring them into the state and plant them in the inland lakes. And the first year I was down there was 1910, and I sent out 13 carloads of black bass from off the river that season with about 35,000 fish to the carload. In fact, there were so many bass taken away from the river that year that the editor of the paper at La Crosse got after Mr. Nevins and raised the dickens with him. And the next year he sent me over there and he said, go to that editor of the paper in La Crosse and tell him that you're going to plant all the fish back in the river. So I went and got in touch with him and told him what I wanted. And I said, I want to get a crew from here to help me do the work. And he said, okay, I'll go with you and we'll round up a crew. So he went out to a saloon and got in touch with a saloon keeper who was in the habit of hiring a lot of men to work on what they used to call wing dams on the river. And he said to that fellow, this man wants some men to help him catch fish. Well, the fellow said, I'll get him some men right away. So we started out from one saloon to the other, and the first place we struck, we found a fellow by the name of Shy. I never knew what his last name was, but he had club feet, and both his feet were turned right straight back like that, and he walked one over the other like this. And he said, yes, I'll help him, sure. Well, we rounded up the crew, and that afternoon I went down to Isle de Plume, a place that we used to go out from and keep our boats. And they had a little place where they kept their tools just across the bridge. And as I went across, I was going to get some nets ready to seine out these fish. And as I went across, I saw the feet of somebody sticking out from behind this house. And I went out there and looked. And there was old Shy, drunk as he could be, laying there with his face up in the sun and the flies all over him. And I said to myself, well, there's one man anyway that won't be on hand tomorrow morning. And at 6 o'clock the next morning, I went down to the boat and there was Shy, all ready to work. And I never had a man who was a better man to work than that club-footed fellow. Well, the car, we ran over the state from place to place and planted fish all over the state. And we, in those days, Nevins never cared about how hard men had to work. The harder he could make a man work, the better he liked it. He used to tell one man who had charge of a fish hatchery at Sheboygan that you can come down to Madison now and spend your vacation and mow the swamp. and he had to mow the swamp with a scythe, and that was his vacation. And that was the way Nevins looked at things in those days. So to keep these fish alive in these tanks, you had to dip the water with a dipper and hold it up like this, aerate it back and forth. And we had one man who used to start out from Genoa, Wisconsin at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and never get rid of his fish until the next afternoon. And he was constantly dipping those fish from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till 3 o'clock the next day. And he never failed to get his fish through in fine shape. Another question, Doctor?
Well, it might be interesting the way they used to plant them. We used to order fish from the state, and they'd meet them with horses, and they came in milk cans.
That's the way we used to plant trout.
Yeah.
Instead of filling these big tanks up and putting the trout in them, we'd put them in cans and put the cans in the tanks and ship them all over the state. We did that from every hatchery. Anyone else got something to say, or anyone else got a question? I've run down.
Wilder Oars one of the first hatcheries in the state?
At the time that Wilder Oars was established in 1907, there was a hatchery at Madison, Wisconsin, a trout hatchery at Madison, Wisconsin. There was a walleye pike hatchery at Woodruff, Wisconsin. And there was a walleye pike hatchery at Delafield, Wisconsin. And that's all the hatcheries there were in the state up to the time that Wild Rose was established in 1907. In 1944, when I retired, we had a hatchery at Westfield. We had a hatchery at Spooner, Wisconsin. Another one near Antigo. I'll add one more. At the time that Wild Rose was here, that was Bayfield. It was a station at Bayfield at the time that Wild Rose was established. But I established a hatchery at Walpaca over here, a bass hatchery. And I established a hatchery at Osceola, St. Croix Falls, and I've forgotten how many there were when I was through. But there was Bayfield and Madison, and Wild Rose and Woodruff and Delafield, about five hatcheries, and I think there was about 15 when I got through. But the biologists at the present time, I think, have discontinued almost all of the hatcheries in the state of Wisconsin, believing that it isn't necessary to hatch and plant fish anymore. That's the idea that the boys that graduate from the university have with reference to the fishery operations. And I must tell you about one thing that's very sad to my heart, more so than anything else that has happened since I was retired in 1944. And that is the destruction, the absolute destruction of the lake trout fishing on Lake Michigan. You people here, while you used to get lake trout once in a while, I presume, were not so particularly interested in this particular question as people that were closer and had more access to the wonderful fish for the lake trout for eating. But several years before I was retired, efforts were made to discontinue the collection of lake trout and the propagation of lake trout on Lake Michigan in Wisconsin. One particular meeting that was held at Two Rivers, Wisconsin by the commission, where they made a strong effort, those who were opposed to my operations, made a strong effort to persuade the commission to discontinue the work. And I told them at that time, in fact, the chairman of the commission turned the meeting over to one man at Two Rivers by the name of Butch LaFon, who was very much opposed to my operations on Lake Michigan. And he had about a dozen men testify and tell stories about what was being done and how we were destroying the lake trout and how detrimental it was and all this kind of stuff. And I sat there and got madder and madder, and finally I made up my mind that if I had a chance to say anything to the commission, I'd give them both barrels, which he gave me a chance to do after the other fellows had gotten through. And I said to them at that time, "Gentlemen, if you discontinue this work, there isn't a man in this room, not a single man in this room, that will ever live to see the fish come back to the point that they are at the present time." And I said further, we catch for taking eggs, we catch about 300,000 pounds a year. And the commercial fishermen that we have on Lake Michigan catch about 5 million pounds every year for commercial purposes. And I said, if the natural reproduction will take care of the necessary requirements to keep up the increase of fish or keep up the supply of fish, why doesn't the 700,000 pounds take it, do it? And I just quit right there. And two of the commissioners followed me out of the room and they said, how many more thousands and millions do you suppose there is in the lake? I said, I haven't any idea, but I know that we're going to catch 5 million pounds next year. I know that because we've been catching them for the last 20 years. Well, the commissioner said the propagation will go on. The minute I was retired in 1944, all the work on Lake Michigan stopped, including Michigan, Wisconsin, and Illinois. And I saw the man who kept the statistics for us at Sturgeon Bay in Florida 3 or 4 years ago. He came down to see me and I said, "Matt, how many lake trout did they catch last year? How many do you suppose?" 350 pounds. They had utterly destroyed the lake trout operations on Lake Michigan. And the biologists claim now that it was all because of the Lampert eel. Well, I'm here to tell you that the Lampert eel was in the lake when I came into the state in 1909. I saw plenty of evidence on the fishes that were caught in Lake Michigan at Milwaukee of Lampert eel at that time. But the little fish that we planted in the lake and kept planting in the lake ate up the Lampert eel and kept them down. And the minute they stopped the propagation, up went the Lampert eel and down went the trout. Another question?
Do you know how the site of the wildlife
pasture happened to be chosen? Yes. I think I told you that. Because Mr. Nevins wanted a place where he could raise trout to fingerling size before planting them. And he was sure that this beautiful supply of water here at Wild Rose was just the thing to do it. And that's the reason he located here. There's another place just like this over at Waupaca. I don't know whether you've ever been over there to that place or not, but it's about 7 miles out of Waupaca. And we built a bass hatchery there, but it was trout water. It was good spring water. And came out of a hill just like it does here. They've discontinued that place entirely. It's one of the best places to raise smallmouth black bass in the United States. There's no other place in the United States to compare with the water that runs out of that spring up there at Waupaca. And Nevins wanted a place where he could raise fish to fingerling size, because at that time the practice was in all the states to get rid of the fish as soon as the sack was absorbed. Plant them in the streams and get rid of them, because it costs an awful lot of money to feed fish up to a larger size. But Nevins felt that it would pay to do it, and that he hoped to get money to do it. The most money that I ever had for the operations of the Fisheries Division in the 22 years that I was in charge down in Madison was about $325,000. The last report that I got from the last report that I remember of, the Fisheries Division of Wisconsin had $8 million to spend. $8 million. And they shut down more than half of the hatcheries. And where does the money go? Another question. Have I answered all those things, Helen?
Why have the ponds been...
change
in our own country, and why have all the picnic tables gone, and the fireplaces, and why is it no longer a tourist attraction? You know as well as I do. You all do. The system has changed. The biologists have taken charge of things, and they don't believe in such things as that. They don't believe in keeping the grounds up or having the place look decent.
It seems that the natural ponds would have been a much more logical place for raising the fish than these artificial cement troughs.
Well...
Other than for convenience there, an eyesore.
Yes, I don't understand why. I can't see why, I can't understand why they changed the program here unless it was because of the plan that we have at Osceola and St. Croix Falls. We have raceways up there rather than ponds. But the topography of the ground is altogether different, the conditions are altogether different, and everything is different in those other places than it is here. These ponds were originally built with stone banks, and we had two wonderful men here. One of them, John Gunther, was a man who was able to lay up a stone wall without any mortar or anything of that kind, this dry stone wall. But and it was very picturesque and very pretty and looked nice. And that was one of the reasons that Nevins wanted it built that way. But it was not practical. The fish would get in between the stones and we'd lose lots of them. And it was much improved when all those stone walls were cemented up and all the holes were closed up. It was much better that way. But the cement raceways that they've built out there now, I don't know why they changed, I'm sure. Unless it just was to destroy the beauty of the place. And it certainly is such a looking place that I just said goodbye, I'll never go there again. But that's the condition of most of the places. Delafield was a beautiful place in the summer resort part of the country, and the ponds are now used for holding carp. And over here at Waupaca, they just don't do anything over there at all. There's a most wonderful place there to raise smallmouth bass, black bass in the United States.
Then how is this fabulous amount of money being spent?
Huh?
How is this money being spent?
Well, mostly on reports. I had about 60 or 70 people working for me And I think there's about 200 or 300 working in the same job now. And they all make reports. And they all save those reports down into Madison. They're all put in files down in Madison. Never looked at or paid any attention to. And kept there for about 10 years, and then they're taken out to the fish hatchery and burned up. But we gotta have reports. Everybody's gotta make out long reports at all the fish hatcheries. Just keep busy, I guess.
Isn't that the hatchery building being used for anything down here now then?
I don't know whether it is or not. I presume that not the big building. I don't think the big building is being used at all. It may be in the spring for rearing a few trout, but there's a small building there where they do their hatching. I haven't been in the big building for a long, long time. I don't know just what is going on, but I'm more sorry about what was done to the lake trout operations on Lake Michigan than anything else in the whole operations. One of the boys, to give you an idea of how the practical men that I had working for me, I didn't have any men who had graduated the university in the biology department or any other department. All my men were local fellows picked up at the different places where the hatcheries were established, and all the information they had about the propagation of fish was what they learned from practical experience. And naturally, when these fellows, these biologists came in and commenced to tell these fellows what to do and what not to do, which was probably in many instances contrary to their teaching and to their learning and to their information, well, they just naturally got mad. And one of the fellows down at Westfield got into a regular row with a biologist, and they called him names, and I don't know if he had a little fist fight with him. But anyway, he was reported by the biologist, and the officials in Madison suspended him for 10 days. And you can imagine how that fellow feels about biologists. I was down there one day and came along to the hatchery, and I hadn't seen this fellow for a long time, and I said, And the fellow in charge there said, "You want to congratulate this man?" And said, his wife just gave him a nice bouncing boy. And this fellow said to me, "Yes, I've got a wonderful boy." He says, "He was born so and so and so and so. And he says, I'm going to give him a wonderful education. I'm going to send him down to Madison, and I'm going to have him take a biology course. And when he graduates that biology course, I'm going to take him out in the woods and shoot him." So you get an idea how they felt about the biologist. Well, I guess that'll finish my little talk.
Do you think there's any possibility of ever making the hatchery a beautiful place again, where people would like to come and spend a Sunday afternoon?
I very much doubt it. I very much doubt it, because the policy is so entirely changed by the attitude of the biologists who seem to have control of the operations now. And as another instance of the way biologists operate, I have a daughter living down in Spring Grove, Illinois. And her husband has charged the hatchery for the state of Illinois. It's a bass hatchery and a bluegill hatchery, and he has had marvelous, marvelous success and raised quantities of fish, great quantities of fish. I've known him to fill up his hatchery and plant them out 4 or 5 or 6 times during the fall. The biologist came along last year and they poisoned all the ponds. And he didn't have fish enough last year to make more than one shipment. And I think they're down there poisoning the ponds again this year, and he won't have any more fish this year than he had last year.
How did they poison the ponds?
They think that they've got to poison the ponds to kill off the weeds and kill off the bugs and kill off everything, and
including the bugs and the weeds and everything else, they kill off all the fish also.
Well, then the policy in other states is much different than it is in Wisconsin.
No, they're all the same. All the same. They raise fish now to larger size before they plant them. But that thing, that method has been going on down in eastern part of the United States for years and years and years and years. But it's got out here now, and all the fish are raised up to a size large enough to catch before they're planted now. That, of course, uses up some of that $8 million because it costs an awful lot of money to raise fish up to that size.
Well, that would present a feeding problem, wouldn't it?
Huh?
That would present a feeding problem.
A very great feeding problem, yes. And that feed nowadays, in comparison to what it used to be, is very, very high.
What do they feed them now?
Well, the majority of hatcheries are feeding a prepared food that's prepared by some big milling company, and including, I don't know what all they have in there. They're little pellets, and they just throw the pellets in the water, and the fish go for them like a chicken. We used to feed meat altogether. Mostly, years ago, when we first started here, we used to feed liver. Liver, of course, is positively the best food to start young fish on. There isn't anything better than beef liver to start young fish on. They'll grow better and be more healthy. I think they use, to start the fish to grow, I think they use more or less liver now. But you know how liver is. We used to buy it for a cent a pound or something like that in large quantities. Gee, you can't buy it now for, I don't know how much they do charge for it.
Well, we thank you, Mr. Webster, for that interesting talk.
Well, you're very welcome, I'm sure.